Welcome back. In part two, I talked about how brokenness, including death, are part of every person's story. Just by simply living on this planet, each of us quickly realizes that life isn't a bed of roses and that trials are a part of daily life, just part of being human. But I also said that these things aren't the whole story. Brokenness and death don't have to have the final word. Because of Jesus, brokenness and death don't have to be the defining theme of anyone's story, because God has told a story that's true for every person ever born. In God's story, there's healing, another chance to start fresh, power to face life's challenges, and abundant, unstoppable life. In God's bigger story, each personal story is giving meaning and purpose, a point, a reason, and that point is not brokenness and death. It's hope. Hope for resurrection power and a fresh start right now, and hope for never-ending life on a new earth where every wrong will be made right. Life in a glorious resurrected body in the future. God's story, recall, has the power to rewrite those parts of our stories that we don't like, the parts we find hurtful and shameful, and the parts we would rather not speak of. Through Jesus, God invites everyone to join their story, no matter how complicated, messed up, or shameful it is. To His. Through Jesus, God invites everyone to find their true identity as His beloved son or daughter. In part two, I also talked about God's intention for humanity, and more specifically, I began to explore three major themes that are in the creation story. They are major because they start here, run through all the separate writings in the Bible, and tie God's story into a unified whole. These themes all have to do with God's relationship with His creation, and especially with humanity. And they address questions like, why Jesus? Why God's story? How does my story fit in? What's my purpose? Is there more than this? You know, the kind of questions people ask when they're thinking about the big things of life. These three themes are connected to each other, so we can talk about them like this. Because in the beginning, humans know God and that He's perfectly good, theme number one. They trust and obey Him precisely because they know He is good and wants the best for them, theme number two. And since they are in a relationship of perfect peace with Him, they live in His presence, meaning there's no wall between them and God, theme number three. There's perfect peace between humanity and God, and as a result, among humans themselves, and between human and non-human creation. So, let's pick up where we left off. In the beginning, humanity knows God. That is, they know who He is, and so they know who they are in this relationship. They know Him. Meaning they know He is God and they serve or worship Him by carrying out the task of filling the earth and creating culture within the boundaries He put in place. They are in command of creation, but they know they are second in command to God. God has given them everything they need to flourish, including His perfect peace. This perfect peace flows from the unbroken relationship humans have with a perfectly good and loving God. This is their true identity. They know that they are the beloved of God. They know God, and they know He loves them beyond measure. They know they are people who are much loved. In the beginning, humans trust and obey God, not because He's some petty, power-hungry tyrant who wants to control them, but because they trust that He's perfectly good and loving, and He knows what He's doing when it comes to looking out for His beloved, including providing life-giving boundaries. To know God as God is to trust Him. If you trust He's God and that you're His beloved, then you'll trust that He'll act like it, always and every time, with respect to everything and every situation, period. It's the rubber hitting the road of life. Will you do what you say you believe? So, in this lovely abundant garden that we talked about, the humans are given the chance to go beyond paying lip service. To go beyond just saying, "Sure, God, we trust you." We all know instinctively that lip service is not enough for a relationship to be real. Saying you love someone doesn't cut it if you don't act like it. So, will the humans trust God enough to do what He says? Will they trust that He has the best intentions for them? What will they do when they are given the chance to choose something else, something other than God and His boundaries? What will they do when the rubber hits the road? Enter stage right. Enter into God's story, into the garden, into this perfect relationship between humans and God, the opportunity to make a choice when the rubber hits the road of real life. Enter stage right, the talking serpent, and the forbidden fruit hanging from the tree of knowledge of good and evil that God told humans not to eat from. Enter stage right, the opportunity to not trust, not to obey, to take and eat and break the relationship of peace and trust with God. Enter the opportunity to really show that they mean it and are not just paying lip service to a nice idea. This takes us to part three, how humans messed up and what happens as a consequence. Now, we've already talked about the evocative symbolic language in the creation story found in the beginning of Genesis and why it's there. So with this in mind, here's my take on what's going on with the talking snake and the forbidden don't eat it fruit. Now, let's not get hung up on talking snakes. The fact that the seductive invitation to bail on this relationship of trust with God comes to humanity in the form of a talking serpent is not as important as the fact that it comes from a fellow creature, a created thing. This goes straight to the idea of having the opportunity to listen to and then to choose something other than God to provide what God can and does already provide and provides perfectly and abundantly. It's the rubber hitting the road. God or something other than God. Now remember, God has already given humanity unlimited access to everything in the garden, including the tree of life. Except for that one single, little itty-bitty stinky tree, the tree of knowledge of good and evil. What's with that? Up until now, humans have not experienced evil. That is, all things not good, aka not from or of God. That's evil. God has commanded humans not to eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil since, because He is God and He loves them perfectly, He knows that anything outside of Himself, His goodness, is not good for them. He loves them. They are His beloved, and in Him is everything they need. All they have to do is trust that this is true. Here comes the seductive invitation from the talking serpent. Second point, the invitation is seductive because it goes right to the heart of humanity's relationship with God and their freedom to choose to stay in that relationship or not. It goes to the heart of God's goodness, His perfect love for them. their knowledge of this and their acting on this knowledge by trusting him. The talking serpent plants a seed of doubt in their minds. Is God really good? He may have given you all this stuff in the garden, but it seems to me like he's keeping you from having something that he knows will make you like him. That's not really good and loving of him, is it? Why would you want to obey him, especially when this particular fruit he told you not to eat, ooh, smells really good and looks mighty tasty? Why wouldn't he want you to have it, unless he really isn't all that good? They fall for it. They choose not to trust God, but rather to trust the creature. They think that knowing all about evil will make them more powerful, more like God. They want to be like God, and they fall for it. They eat the forbidden fruit, they taste evil. Now they come face to face with all things not God and know what not good is. Enter shame, something that's a part of every person's story since that time. The shame that comes with rebellion against someone who loves them perfectly. The shame that comes with crossing the boundaries God put in place. Look, everyone has a sense of what these boundaries are, even if they don't know who God is, and even if they don't know that these boundaries come from him. How so? We all have a conscience, put there by the God who created us, that lets us know when we've crossed the line. And if we're real, all of us have crossed the line at some time, in some way. And if we're real, there's a whole list of things we regret doing. If we're real, all of us know what shame feels like. It's part of the human condition. Okay, so in the story, the man and the woman take and eat the forbidden fruit. They cross the line, and they're ashamed. For the first time, they realize they're naked. They're exposed for who they are. The party that chooses to bail on the relationship. They eat, and at this point, the relationship between them and God is broken. The beloved rebel against the one who loves them perfectly. Remember Bob and Jane in part one? Bob loves his wife Jane with all his heart, but Jane decides she'd rather be with someone else and leaves. She breaks it off, and Bob gives her what she wants. He gives Jane the divorce, despite the fact that his love for her hasn't changed one bit. He knows that despite his love, the relationship is basically over once Jane chooses to leave. Bob loves her, so he lets her go with the hope that she might change her mind and return. Same with God. So he lets the humans go, and they get the something other than God that they wanted. But they no longer have access to the garden. Think of God giving them the divorce they asked for. They're cut off from his presence. They've created a rift between God and themselves. They may have a memory of him and their unbroken relationship with him, but now there's a wall between them. They know something other than him and his goodness. They've tasted its seductive power, and it continues to seduce them. Just read today's headlines and compare them to the stories in the Bible about Cain and Abel, Lamech, all the way up to Noah to see what I mean. Murder, violence, all kinds of bad stuff that happens when humans turn on each other. You can find these stories in Genesis right after the creation story. So, humanity gets what it asks for, the opportunity to play God. But with this opportunity comes knowledge of what life is like without a relationship with God. With human rebellion comes knowledge of evil. And because humans are created and limited, just because they want to play God doesn't make them God, They lack the power to fend evil off. It's bigger and badder than they thought. Self-interest consumes them. As I said, read the following chapters in Genesis right after the creation story and read the daily news, and you'll see what I mean. Self-interest all over the place, and it's ugly. The world, insofar as it stands apart from and against God, hasn't gotten much better after the first humans rebel. So, the need for a God-sized rescue plan is just as necessary today as it was back in the garden. More about that later. Let's finish up what happens after the great mess up. It explains why we need a rescue plan. All right, once the humans bail, the job given to them by God to fill the earth and create culture keeps going. But it goes without God at the center. It happens without the good and life-giving boundaries that God put in place. It goes without His wisdom to guide humanity in their subduing and ruling. The mission remains, but now there's no access to mission control or to the power source. The humans are booted out of the garden, so the mission continues without access to the tree of life. Death rears its ugly head. Without God at the center, God's perfect peace is shattered, not only between Him and His beloved, but also between humans themselves and between humans and the rest of creation. Enter the opposite of goodness and abundant life. Enter evil and death. Genesis spells out the consequences of the great mess up like this. In the last part of the great mess up, after the humans bail, God confronts the man and the woman about eating the forbidden fruit and tells them what life from now on is going to be like without Him at the center. This part is written in the form of ancient Hebrew poetry, and because it's poetry, it speaks to the heart. It spells out the consequences of human rebellion against God, humanity's need for a God-sized rescue plan, and God's mercy and compassion. Let's take a look. It's full of deep stuff because it's poetry. All right, so remember that when God created the universe, He put humans in charge of creation and told them to rule and subdue the earth. In other words, to create culture. God also told them to fill it or to multiply. All of this was supposed to happen with God at the center within the context of His goodness and peace. What happens as a consequence of the great mess up goes right to the heart of this. Keep in mind that this part of the story, we can call it the confrontation, is poetry. So it says a lot more than plain vanilla statements can say. Remember, the stuff we talked about, stars are giant balls of hot gas versus they're diamonds in the sky. We talked about this in part two. Both statements are true. The second one gets at the beauty of stars, which is a concept more difficult to convey. Or if you like, think of a piece of music that expresses joy versus the definition of the word joy that you find in the dictionary. The first, the piece of music, speaks to the mind and the heart. The second, just to the mind. You get what I mean. Same for this Hebrew poetry that we're going to look at. So back to the ancient Hebrew poetry in The Confrontation. Earlier in the creation story, the prophet... Remember, prophets are folks who hear from God and relay things to people that they couldn't otherwise know, like how God spoke the universe into existence. So recall, the prophet tells us that God created humanity in His image as male and female. Now, God is neither male nor female. He's not human. He's God. But humans are one of the two sexes. Both sexes are made in God's image, and both sexes are given the command to rule and subdue and to fill the earth. Now we get the necessity of having a male-female duo to multiply, but sometimes there's confusion about the rule and subdue part. Let's just say some folks see God as first in command, followed by man and second in command, and finally woman as third in command. But the problem with this line of thinking is that it confuses what God intended for humanity as his beloved with what happens after they eat the forbidden fruit. As I said, Genesis tells us that man and woman are equally human, since both are made in the image of God, and both are commanded and empowered by God to be second in command. There's no mention of a third in command among them, and by extension, among humans. In other words, there's no hint of domination or rule of one human over the other. They're at peace with one another. We can take two things from this. Since humanity as a whole is either one sex or the other, and every human is made in the image of God, human beings, regardless of sex, are equal and are to work together to fill the earth and create culture. Second, when we think of male and female as a pair, like in marriage, there's no third in command there either. They're to work as a pair, as one flesh, in filling the earth and creating culture. Now, it's really interesting what the poetry tells us happens after the humans rebel against God. Remember, at this point, they've tasted things not good and not God, and have broken peace with him. Earlier in the story, before they eat the fruit, we're told that God creates the man out of the earth and then creates the woman out of the man's side. All of this points to the fact that both are created beings and to the fact of their essential unity. She is bone of his bone and flesh of his flesh. So together they stand apart from all other creatures. They're the same as far as their humanity goes. Both are made in the image of God. And though there are important differences between them, these are secondary to the primary fact that they are equally human, equally made in the image of God. Like I said before, being made in the image of God is the thing that unifies all human beings. Okay, back to the confrontation and the poem. Things change big time here in two really important ways. As far as God's command to fill the earth, the first big change is addressed to the woman and goes to the obvious need to bear children in order to get the filling of the earth part done. Now, this part of the poem is difficult to translate, and people debate over how best to do it. Remember, it's written in ancient Hebrew. My take on this goes within the bigger context of God's story, which I think gives us the best clue as to how to read this. So, God tells the woman that because she ate the fruit from the tree she wasn't supposed to eat from, her conceptions, my translation, will increase, and in pain she'll bear children. I take this to mean mainly emotional pain. You see, prior to falling for the seductive invitation to be like God, there was no death. This means that multiplying and filling the earth didn't involve either the mother's death during childbirth or the death of infants and children and the painful, agonizing emotional suffering that comes with losing either a wife or a child or both. So the way that humanity was supposed to carry out the first command is distorted by evil, the not good of death and loss, because God is no longer at the center of it. As a consequence, it becomes much harder to fill the earth, since filling now involves suffering and death. Next, God tells the man that because he's also eaten the fruit, his efforts to eke out food from the earth will be far from easy, and will more often than not result in the not enough for everybody reality of famine, starvation, and death. Prior to falling for the seductive invitation to be like God, food was not an issue. Because he was at the center, God provided everything humanity needed to live well. Now, working the earth to fill the planet with people is seriously handicapped by all the not good things that affect the level of food production necessary for survival. Things like famine and drought. Also, because agriculture is the basis for civilization, humanity's culture-creating power is equally distorted by evil. Think about this. Resource grabbing, which includes grabbing arable land, causes wars and exploitation of the planet. We know this. It's a fact of human history. Now, as I said, this is poetry, so just because God addresses the woman and the man individually doesn't mean that what he says to each of them only applies to male and female respectively. Think about this. The loss of a child doesn't just affect the mother, does it? Likewise, famine and drought doesn't just affect men, does it? Both of these things affect both sexes and make it painful for humanity as a whole to survive, to fill the earth, and to create culture. One more thing about this. In the poem, God pronounces that death has now entered creation when he specifically addresses the man. Now, clearly, both male and female people die. So all the consequences apply to all humans, regardless of sex. In short, the great mess up humanity's declaration of divorce from, rebellion against God, results in pain and suffering tainting humanity's work in filling the earth and creating culture. But that's not it. Domination of one human over the other becomes the norm. How so? Let's dig a little deeper. Remember I said that according to Genesis, God made the man from the dust of the earth? In the confrontation, we already talked about how God tells the man that he will now return to dust, meaning he and she, as we already talked about, will eventually die. We also talked about how the perfect peace that existed between humanity and the planet is shattered. Food production becomes difficult. Putting these two things together, we see that the poem poetically tells us that the man's source, the earth, basically turns against him, since eking out food from the earth that he was created from is now full of labor that often fails to produce enough food for everybody. Likewise, following the poetry, the woman is poetically told that her source, the man, remember, she's made from his side? The man will now rule over her. The perfect peace between male and female, both of whom make up humanity, is shattered. And so, by extension, the perfect peace among all human beings in all their various groupings, tribes, communities, and nations is shattered. Enter the violence that comes with the impulse to rule over, to dominate, which litters human history from the beginning to the present. God's command to humanity to subdue and rule the earth is distorted and corrupted by violence, as the impulse to dominate others corrupts humanity's culture-creating power, seeping into every political, economic, and social structure. All those things that make up culture, all across history. In sum, this part of the story that we find in Genesis teaches us that God is perfectly good and that he created humanity to be his beloved, his own sons and daughters, made in his image, on whom he could lavish his love. Not only did he provide everything his beloved needed to flourish, but he also gave them the power to share in his creative power by filling the earth and by subduing and ruling, creating God-centered culture. God invited his beloved to live in his love, not as robots pre-programmed to do his bidding, but as the one they could and should trust as the almighty loving God who provides everything they need to live exuberantly in perfect peace with themselves, each other, and the rest of creation. All they had to do is trust him. Free to accept the invitation to stay in this relationship or not, humanity fell for the age-old temptation to doubt God's goodness, to not trust him, and to look for fulfillment from things other than him. Things like other people, money, status, beauty, food, drugs, alcohol, family, job, pleasure, self, social media, etc., etc., etc. The list goes on and on. And if we're honest, we all have to admit that we've sampled from this list. We've all rebelled. And all of these individual rebellions are reflected on a grand scale in the world's political, economic, and social structures. That's about as obvious as the noses on our faces. Let's be real. These things, these institutions are flawed, and none of them seems to deliver as promised. We've all tasted evil, and because we're not God, we're easy prey to its seductive power. Rebelling against God also means rebelling against our identity as God's beloved. Think about this. If God no longer gives a person their identity, what does? Something has to. Remember the list? Whatever it is, it becomes God. Some of those things aren't bad in themselves. Things like family and work and a good meal, those things are good. But once even a good thing becomes the end-all and be-all of fulfillment and identity, once it becomes absolute, it always and eventually ends up being a cruel master. Why? None of these things can fulfill in the long run. They're all created things and limited. We just end up needing more and more of whatever it is that we're hooked on. And at some point, it either dries up, it leaves us, or it disappoints us. Then what? On to the next thing. God created us in his image, and whether we know it or not, care about it or not, or wish it were otherwise, he's the one who gives us our true identity. And apart from him, our quest to find fulfillment will never end. So, at the end of the confrontation, the man and the woman are banned from the garden. God still loves them, but they've asked for a divorce. They've divorced him, and as a consequence, because they doubted his goodness, they no longer know him or trust the life-giving boundaries he placed around them. They no longer obey him. They know evil. They go their own way. At this point, the three themes come together. They no longer know God like they did before. And because they no longer know him like they did before, they no longer trust and obey him. As a consequence, they no longer live in a life-giving relationship with him. They live apart from his presence. As a consequence, they no longer know who they are. But fortunately for us, the story doesn't end here. Death, violence, domination, suffering, all those things that are not God don't have the final word because God's determined to bring his beloved back to himself. He loves them and he wants them to know what their true identity is. So the rest of God's story is about God reaching out to humanity, giving them the chance over and over again to know him, not just as mighty creator and all that is good, but also as compassionate and merciful, the God of second, third, and fourth chances to trust and obey him, reject evil, and to come back into his presence, the three major themes that tie the whole story together. Now, we get a hint of God's crazy mercy and compassion and love at the very end of the confrontation. Remember what happened when the man and woman eat the fruit before God confronts them? They suddenly realize they're naked, and for the first time, they feel shame. What does God do? He clothes them. He doesn't need to do this. They're the ones who rebelled and asked for a divorce, but he does it. And then he begins drawing them back into a relationship with himself. Enter stage left, Abraham and Israel, and the next part of God's story. Before I go, you may be wondering about what happens to that crafty talking serpent who offers the seductive invitation. Remember I said that the important thing is that it's a creature and that this points to our tendency to look to created things rather than to God for fulfillment? I'm going to introduce something here that relates to Jesus' role in God's rescue plan that I'll talk about more in part 5. We know from the Bible that God didn't just create the universe. He also created the angels, his messengers and attendants. They exist with God in the spiritual world. We also know that they're created beings that are a little bit above humans. Finally, we know that some of them rebelled against God. Anyway, the serpent more than likely represents the leader of the angelic rebellion, otherwise known as Satan. You may have heard of him. He's always roaming around with the rest of his crew trying to recruit rebels. There's an important clue in the poem that supports this. God tells the serpent that because he convinced the humans to eat the forbidden fruit, he, God, will put hostility between the serpent and the woman and between its offspring and hers. The prophet says it like this, quote, "He will crush your head and you will strike his heel," unquote. Ultimately, the God-man Jesus, born to a woman like any baby, God in flesh and bone, will crush the serpent's head, the only one who can and who does stand up to evil. Jesus conquers evil on the cross precisely when it looks like the serpent's fangs have inflicted a fatal bite. Jesus dies, the fatal bite. But 3 days later, he rises. Death is crushed. Remember, this is poetry. The fact that God curses the serpent and tells it that it will crawl on its belly and eat dust all its life gets at the fact that the angels who rebel against God are cast out of the spiritual realm and hurled to the earth. In other words, they lose their honor and status as angels. Complete demotion. They're in the dust. They no longer rank with the angels and no longer live with God as his messengers and attendants. Satan and his crew have divorced God and no longer are in relationship with him. Just the opposite. All they want to do is bring everyone down with them. This gets clearer in Jesus' story, Jesus, the God-sized rescuer. But before we get to Jesus, we need to look at the part of the Bible, the Old Testament, that tells the story of Abraham and Israel. So, I invite you to go to the next part of God's story at GodStoryYourIdentity.org to hear about God's story part 4, a God-sized rescue plan. Remember, there's a place for you in God's story. The invitation is open. Jesus is holding out his hands to you. All you have to do is tell him you're sorry for rebelling and turning your back to him and say, "Yes, Jesus, I want to be part of your story. I want to know what it's like to be God's beloved. I'm tired of this, that, or the other thing, fill in the blank, ruling my life. And I want to know what it's like to find peace and fulfillment in you." If you'd like to hang out with other folks looking to get to know Jesus better, folks wanting to experience God in everyday life, folks who want to hear more about God's story and be part of it, come and see what River of Grace is about. We can connect you with a group of friends on a journey through life together with God.